Well, that was very short, very sweet, and left us lots of room for discussion. Now, do remember that this part of the morning is yours, and use it sensibly. Can I have your first question to Adam? He has elected to answer each question separately. That stops that. Right. Everybody's satisfied with him? Well, we can go home now. Right, yes.
Well, I must again, I have a certain interest in Wat Tyler, not John Ball. But I live near Dartford, where Wat Tyler is buried, and not very far from there is Blackheath, where Wat Tyler was murdered by the King's men. But I must confess that I haven't read Dream of John Ball, although I've known about it for this years. What I'd like to ask Adam, it seems to me that this whole episode in English history of a rising and attempt by the press class to gain justice holds many, many lessons for the working class, what to do and what not to do. In the first place, the peasants arose with one aim in mind, without any particular thought as to what was, how they were going to do it, what they were going to achieve, and what they would be in its place, with limited aims, which, as you correctly point out, of course, in the long run, wouldn't have made any difference to them at all. Of course, they weren't to know that. Their second big mistake, which has been repeated over and over again in working class history, is to put their faith in a member of the government. In this case, it was the King. They really thought, and I think we find parallels with this in Russia and in quite a few instances from history, they really thought that if the King only knew how badly off they were, he would do something about it. They couldn't conceive that the nobles were oppressing them in the way that they were with the King's knowledge. To them, the King was a figure which they looked up to. So they thought that if they put their complaints before the King would do something about it. This, of course, was absolute nonsense, because the King was just as representative of the then ruling class as the rest of them. And, of course, by doing that, they exposed themselves to putting their demands before the King. And I don't think history records whether Richard actually instigated it himself, or whether it was, they say, it was there were different versions, I think, that what actually happened with Wat Tyler. He was, as I remember it, he was stabbed on the field in talking to the King. Those who favour the ruling class claim that he tried to murder the King and that it was self-defence. But I prefer the other version, that he was done to death, which of course is what usually happens. So the lessons are, don't put your trust in leaders, don't put your trust in asking a father figure to put things right for you, you've got to do it yourself. And the question is, are any of these points brought out in by William Morris?
Well, I mean, just a general comment. I mean, you describe the aims of the peasants' revolt as limited, but in fact, in the circumstances of the time, it was a revolutionary demand to abolish serfdom and to abolish the nobility. I mean, that's what they were in fact demanding, similar to what happened in England later under Cromwell and in the French Revolution. You get rid of the exploiting nobility. I mean, that would have been that was a revolutionary demand, but I think you're underestimating also the extent to which it was organised. I mean, there were secret code words and passwords which they used to communicate with each other. I mean, one of them is mentioned in here when they first meet these people coming from Canterbury to this village between Sittingbourne and Chatham. They have to exchange a passwords. I mean, that's been confirmed by other well, Morris was basing it on what other historical researchers said. So there was a degree of organisation, but it would come back to the point again that this was a sort of premature bourgeois revolution. I mean, the people who were, I mean, none of the leaders was in fact a peasant. I mean, John Ball and Jack Straw were priests, and Wat Tyler was a tailor from the towns. So it would make sense. These are people who have acquired some property and some property rights, who want to go the whole hog and get these nobles off their backs and no longer have to pay taxes to them. But does Morris say anything here about going to the king and saying, look, he's a young king, he's new, he doesn't know what's going on, and so on? I mean, that's a thing which is attributed to John Ball by this French chronicler. We don't know if he actually did say, but it's the sort of thing that people, as they ruling class, might have expected peasants to have believed, and I suppose maybe some of them did it because one of the demands was that there should be no sovereign, there should be no lord in England except the king. I mean, Morris doesn't mention anything about that in here. Doesn't, I mean, that bit is in fact socialist when they quote John Ball's speech. Leave that last bit out. But even so, if you read it carefully, what John Ball is made to say by this French chronicler is, we will go to the king, we'll ask for our rights, and if we don't get them, we'll find another way of getting them. So it's two options, if you like, to return to that, to yesterday's discussion. Peaceably if we may, forcibly if we must, I think it was there, would have been their attitude.
I'd like to know, the terminology of the tight housing, is that used in that period, tight housing?
Mm. I turn to our expert on the Middle Ages, Ken.
Tight housing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I have no idea, but there was something I wanted to, anybody else has.
What were tied houses?
I mean, it's a term. The workers only live in the house.
Oh, sorry, yeah. But no, I think that comes at a later period in time, because the the basic manorial system was that there would be the lord of the manor with his farm, and there'd be people living, no doubt, in tied houses on his farm, his own or personal serfs or personal slaves, and the other peasants who were living on their own lands, who were forced to spend part of the time cultivating the estates of their lords. But when they abolished labour service, the money rent was paid. It was still paid for people who'd who'd seized the land, so there was still exploitation. So the abolition of feudalism wouldn't have been the abolition of exploitation. It'd been the abolition of these legal rights which the lords of the manor had to extract service from from people. But tied housing survived right up until today, doesn't it?
Yeah.
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 You said that Wat Tyler and John Ball weren't peasants, they were priests. But of course, as a French historian, Bertrand de Jouvenel, pointed out, that the priests, in fact, were drawn from the peasantry. The village priest would always have his eye open for any kid who was... There were village schools who were... The priest, in fact, as in many religions, was in fact the schoolmaster, and any child who showed, any boy who showed promise and who learned, really got hold of reading and writing, was always put forward with a view to becoming the priest, entering the priesthood. The priests didn't reproduce themselves, they were celibate, they couldn't have done, and they had to be drawn from the peasantry. And again, Bertrand de Zouvenel points out that the ruling class, if we'll accept that term for the moment, I have serious misgivings about it. Likewise, anybody showing signs of being a really useful thug, a lagerlout, would be taken up by the aristocracy, the ruling elite, and trained in the art of war or of fighting. But I think to make sense of any of this, we've got to consider how we or they got to where they were from where they'd be. These waves of people have been emigrating into this country for thousands of years, and they've continued. I mean, now it's still going on. Waves of people coming in. But at that time, I'm talking about the Dark Ages, the land was virtually very, very thinly populated, covered with trees. The new arrivals, the same the way the West was won, subsequent centuries. They cleared a bit of forest to provide ground for cultivation and so on. Each village was self-sufficient, except that there were weekly markets or monthly markets, usually weekly, where they could get hold of things they couldn't supply themselves, like salt and iron, principally. Now, the ruling class, it's very difficult in the Dark Ages, before 1066, before the Norman invasion, to point to any kind of ruling class. And subsequent centuries, who was it? Christopher Hill, I think, points out that the idea of an Anglo-Saxon in England, free of a ruling class, lasted for centuries. But with the Normans, I believe the figure is 30,000 of them, who really are Scandinavian in origin, settled in the north of France, were absorbed by the French culture, and re-emerged French-speaking, invaded England, and took over and formed a ruling class, a foreign ruling class of their own. But in fact, they weren't a class in the sense they weren't part of the population. They were simply a criminal element. And they were characterized by being on horseback. Now, people who were leading a useful life, raising stock, plowing the land, they didn't plow with horses. They didn't have the equipment. They used oxen. Now, I think if we try and reorient our thinking, the ruling class were a lot rather like the American mafia in Chicago and New York in the 20s and 30s, that they were a criminal element. They were not a part of society. They contributed nothing to it. They were in the business of extortion. Or at least that's where they began. Of course, they ended up by removing the means of the peasants catering for themselves, that is the land, and a new system arose. But that was a lot later, in the late 1400s. And I think we have an enormous amount of relearning to do about the whole of this period, because until we understand that, we can't really make sense of where we are.
You want to make comments on that?
Or,
sorry.
Say something about the myth of the Norman yoke. I mean, this became more popular in the time of Cromwell and Winstanley. In fact, if you read Winstanley's writings, he's talking about the Norman yoke. These people came over, from Normandy, and they established themselves as a ruling class, and we won't get our rights back as free-born Englishmen until we've driven them out. And it's true that they, spoke French. I deliberately described the Hundred Years' War as a war between these, their cousins. I mean, that was a language that, they spoke. And when people say, for instance, that the English conquered Ireland in, 1182. Not true. It's the same Norman barons that conquered England, conquered Ireland, and the same thing in Wales. All these nationalist myths, whether they're English, Irish, or Welsh debate, you know, based on the same. I mean, I think there would have been a ruling class of norma, of, you know, of lords and landowners even before 1066. But to you know, one of the other points you mentioned is immigration. I mean, there were at this time quite a few people from Flanders, Flemings, who were had immigrated into London and into East Anglia. And in Chaucer, there's one reference in the Canterbury Tales to the peasants, and what it is to the massacre of Flemings in London, which he attributes to Jack Straw. Well, I mean, he might have got it right on that occasion. So I mean, that's how they, you know, it was perceived, and also in Norwich, some of the people involved in the peasants' vote were, you know, weavers and textile, you know, workers. And you mention, you know, people rising up from the lower class to the upper class. There's a thing in this, an anecdote told by Froissart, of this man who is, you know, says somebody, and his father had been a mason. So the local people surround him and say, "You be our leader, you know, because you're one of us." And he says, "No, I won't be. You know, go away." And then he fights them and he chops off their head and so on. But there's 40,000 of them, unfortunately, and he gets torn to pieces. But I mean, you know, the peasant revolt takes place in southeast England, which was the most developed.
Put your hand up for whether you were scratching yourself. that's
not scratching, now, but that's not okay.
Oh, right.
Go on. I was going to take up this idea of there was no ruling class in Dunkerque. I think that's a highly original claim, but I mean, there is no great evidence about anything in the Dark Ages. That's why it's the Dark Ages. I can quote Stephen Jay Gould, I think, which is absence of evidence, is not evidence of absence. You only have to think of King Canute, Cymbeline, King Stephen, Heroin the Wraith, Alfred. Of course, there were kings in the Dark Ages. There's no question about that. And if there were kings, there were barons. But I think the reason that Pat's coming back in the plane is that you have to think about the ruling class in a completely different way in the Dark Ages than we know it now. For a start, you didn't have a state. There was no nation of Britain in that time. And this leads into the reason why John Ball and Wat Tyler would have gone to the king with their complaints about their treatment, because there was no sense of an overall ruling class. Your oppression was localised to your local manor. You had no conception of what life was like outside that manor in some other part of the country. You had no conception that the king had anything to do with it, or that or you were related to it in any way. It would have seemed, I would guess, it would seem a perfectly logical thing to do. And in fact, going back a long time before the Dark Ages to Roman times, one of the things that quite often happened was that people in a certain governorship would complain to Rome about the behaviour of the local governor, and quite often that governor would be recalled as a result. So it wasn't always a bad thing to do that, to go over somebody's head. But the idea that there was no ruling class as such in the Dark Ages, I can't remember the long that it didn't look like the kind of ruling class we know, but it certainly did exist.
Well, evidence.
Just a minute. Okay.
To add to that, if you go to the British Museum and see the Sutton Hoo remains, that's about the 7th century. The riches of the Sutton Hoo remains weren't held commonly. They were in a ship's burial, and they obviously related to somebody of great power and riches.
I don't speak all the time.
I mean, the Sutton Hoo remains don't indicate that there was a comparatively egalitarian society behind
them. Yes, just a minor point to follow up something earlier said, reasonable to go to the king. It's interesting, the genesis of kingship and the genesis of a nobility are two different tracks of development. and it was an uneasy meeting when they did get together, and it took it's formed over quite a long period of time. Kings were appointed by the people. It's a long history of religious backgrounds, and the king was in fact simply a representative, almost a creature of, as they say, of the population, so, and was regarded in a different way from a nobility, which was imposing a rule. The king didn't rule in the initial, but he was simply the people's representative in ceremonies, principally religious ceremonies and so on. Now, obviously, there was an evolution, and kings were changing their nature. I would think that's the basis for having that attitude towards the king. The king is our king, not their king.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think it's perfectly reasonable to think that in the Dark Ages, despite Ken's alleged lack of evidence, that there was a ruling class. There must have been. If there's any evidence he's looking for, well, the existence of kings and has already been mentioned. And surely that implies that there must have been a ruling class. Now, we can't see black holes in the universe, but we know that they must nevertheless be there. Now, the question of the going to the king for assistance, well, it's well known, surely, that in those days, there wasn't just a struggle between the nobility and the king and the peasantry. There was a struggle going on between the king and the nobility all the time. And often the king and the peasantry would use each other for their own advantage against the nobility. So these things did happen. Now, what I don't understand is the reference in the Dream of John Ball to the difference between conditions in Essex and conditions in Kent. Adam, you say that you never really had a serfdom in Kent. And the conditions there were much better than they were in Essex, just across the Thames estuary. Now, what is the materialist explanation for that? I mean, how do you explain that in history?
I think it's a historical.
Sorry?
It's a historical thing. At the Battle of Hastings, you know, the king was Harold, was the king of England. After Duke William, as he's called in here, had won that battle, he marches on London, and the people of Kent are the first people to say, "Welcome, our new king," and he lets the people there remain owners of the lands which they were under the previous regime. Whereas in the rest of England is then parcelled out amongst his earls and his counts and marquises and so on. So I mean, just a historical reason that there was more ownership of land by the people in that area than in the rest of the country. That's why I think it was revolt for the end of serfdom, but it must have been more than that. It was also making positive demands, like we don't want a nobility, we don't want to pay the poll tax, we don't want to we want to be free to sell our grain or whatever it is and agricultural produce, anywhere. And this was a, if you like, as I say, a sort of pre bourgeois revolution. It wasn't a, I mean that's one of the odd things as to how did you have a leader of one of these revolutions who people have attributed holding communist views. I mean, I don't know whether John Ball did necessarily hold communist views. I mean, the only evidence we've got is a statement in Froissart. I mean, he certainly said there should only be commoners. That that there shouldn't be any nobles. There shouldn't be any serfs. We should all be. Well, you're setting for a classless society. That was clear. Which even that was a revolutionary concept at that time.
Now, Paddy wants to speak again. Anyone else? Okay, Paddy.
Interesting conclusion you might draw from the peasant's report as well, which is the fact that if you think about the whole 1,000-year history between then and now, there was only one peasant involved. Only one. I don't believe that. I think that there's actually quite likely a lot more revolts that never actually made it. Our reasoning is that, going back to the Romans, everybody's heard of Spartacus out by that. know, the slaves got fed up. How many other slave uprisings can you think of? Nobody's ever heard of it. But the fact of the matter is, modern research shows that there's barely a single year went past in the Roman Empire when there wasn't a slave uprising somewhere. It was a constant headache. They just couldn't keep the slaves down all the time. They were always bubbling up somewhere. And I wonder if it wasn't like that for you, really. It wasn't like that in this country. And that this peasant revolt of 1380 is actually just the most well-documented. Well, I mean, it's a speculative question. And an answer.
No, I mean, there are people that have written, you know, books about the Middle Ages, and there are other references to other peasant revolts. But people draw, you know, a distinction between what the in France it's called the Jacquerie, which is just the, you know, the peasants just rise up and they slaughter all the nobles and all educated people and so on. And then it, you know, and then they put down and this peasant revolt in England, which seem to be more organised and have more concrete demands. But I mean, even afterwards, in the following century, you have people like Jacques Cade and so on, and others which, you know, which are recorded, interestingly enough, starting in the same part of the country, which, as I say, you know, East Anglia and Essex and Kent were the most developed parts of England. In fact, Norwich was the second biggest town in England after London, but you know, obviously there'd been a class struggle going on all the time under feudalism.
Just a minute, Max wanting to speak.
Yeah, just to provide a brief and complete answer to your question, Andy. The French historian Mark Block did say that revolts was common to the neoliberal regime in strikes throughout the modern industrial capitalism. And there is a lot of evidence to that. There is another revolt which I discovered, I did an essay on the English paper. Early on in the 14th century, in the 1373, there was a major revolt in Flanders, which in fact lasted for 5 years. Ultimately, of course, was unsuccessful. But there are some very, very well organised by peasant captains. There really wasn't, unlike the English revolt, there was no kind of church element. The clergy were not involved. And there were not noble captains in this either. There's an interesting parallel. Flanders, like the southeastern corners of England, was a very prosperous region, very advanced region compared to those around it, which confirms what we know. People don't tend to revolt against desperation. It tends to be more frustrated hopes when things seem to be advancing and then are held back, as they were in England, by the statute of labourers. I've forgotten what the last part of that point was.
Just quickly, you know, I mentioned briefly in passing that Morris did write something on this, you know, thing in Flanders, you know, the revolt of Ghent. I mean, it's in the form of a poem, and I'm not into poetry, but those of you who are like that sort of Victorian poetry, they, you know, there is a thing called the Revolt of Ghent, which Morris wrote about this thing, and he also, you know, he discovered, which he published in Commonweal, a poem written at that time, which is called Mine and Thine, which is, you know, saying these concepts shouldn't exist. It should be, you know, it should be ours. So, you know, even in this, you know, that event, communistic ideas did surface. But I don't know where you'd get hold of this poem, The Revolt of Ghent. It must be in his collected works or something.
Yes, I've got a couple of problems. One is what historians call periodization. In other words, what happened and when did it happen? And I'm not too clear from what Adam has said that when feudalism came to an end and when capitalism came into its own, I don't know over what kind of period. The second point is, certainly, to back up what's been said before, peasant revolts occurred certainly in France, Italy, and Spain. In France, in particular, throughout the 15th, 16th, and 17th century. the English peasant revolts was nothing out of the ordinary. German peasant revolts, for example, in the 15th century, were extremely well organized. They drew up demands, and the cause of peasant revolts in Germany seems to be, the evidence seems to show that they were a result of increasing population pressure on limited resources, and peasants organized against the ruling class because the ruling class were reasserting their rights to what had been common land, the use of the forests, for example. And I think that there's a book called The History of Peasant Revolts, it's by a French historian called Berset. And he points out that the common factor in peasant revolts was their backward-looking nature. They weren't aimed at changing society for the better. Their demands tended to be for a return to some kind of supposed golden age. You know, things were always better in my dad's time. And that, you know, this lack of ideology meant that they were quite easily defeated. The revolts tended to be single issue, usually against the new imposition of taxation or the commandeering of housing, for example, for purposes of war.
Okay, on first point, but when did capitalism start? Probably started in what's been called the long 16th century. In other words, it starts about towards the end of the 1400s and until the beginning of the 1600s. And, I mean, capitalism depends how you define it. I mean, capitalism could be said to be the world market. I mean, that's the time when when the world market developed, and more countries then became producing for the world market for international trade, and this had an effect on the internal organization of production. But feudalism technically wasn't abolished until England, until sometime under Cromwell. I mean, that's when it was legally abolished, all feudal rights and feudal obligations. But feudalism, I mean, the lord of the manor system was already breaking down, as I said, now in 1381. They were converting labor service into a money payment and so on. So it wasn't an actual decoration. Feudalism is ended, capitalism has started. And in fact, there's this book by Emmanuel Wallerstein called Historical Capitalism, and he makes a point, of course, that the ruling class, which is the ruling class again, the ruling class under capitalism, was composed of two elements. One was the people that, the real bourgeois, come up through the ranks, as it were, and the other one were the successful part of the old feudal ruling class, who were able to convert themselves into capitalists. You know, those who didn't ended up like Don Quixote and went into a decline. Now, in Germany, the peasants' war. Interestingly enough, in this book here, which William Morris wrote with Belford, that's called Socialism as Outcome and Growth. They don't talk about the peasants' revolt. It's Socialism, its outcome, and it's growth and outcome, which William Morris wrote with Belford Bax. It was also originally published under a different title, I think, Socialism from the Root Up, in Commonweal. They don't talk about the peasants' revolt, they talk about the peasants' war in England. But I mean, compared with what happened in Germany, it was a revolt. And I'm interested in this because of the, once again, you get in Germany communistic ideas being thrown up in these peasant revolts. And in fact, on one or two occasions, towns were taken over by the Anabaptists and Husserites and so on. And they did establish common ownership. And, you know, when the nobles conquered it, they, I mean, his name, John of Leiden, he was put in a cage, wasn't he, which is still hanging outside the cathedral in Munster. So you can see his bones, well, they've probably been taken down now, but it was in, you know, this century or something that they actually took them down as a warning to peasants and others not to revolt and, you know, against your ruling class. So, but I don't know whether, can you say these type of revolts were, you know, backward looking. They were certainly caused by the coming of, you know, coming of capitalism, and I think, you know, we'll come back to William Morris. This concept of the change beyond the change. They could not have established communism in England or in Germany or in France at any of these periods of time. But I mean, so communism has to be seen, or socialism has to be seen, if you like, as the change beyond the change. These societies are doomed to go through capitalism.
As a social system, we then have to rely on Adam Smith as detailing it as such. As a complete social system, we
could you speak up, please? Could you speak up?
Yeah.
Oh.
Everybody hear me?
Well, I can't.
I've got very
sharp. No, as a social system, as a ruling class that we would define it today, would you put that at the beginning of that, when Adam Smith defined it, and how the capitalists behaved and how they ruled?
Well, I mean, Adam Smith certainly provided the first sort of analysis of how the capitalist economy worked or was supposed to work. But I think capitalism must be dated before Adam Smith. Was Adam Smith 1780s or 1770s? I think capitalism can be said to come into existence before then. If you like, production for sale ultimately on the world market. It can go back to these, you know, Portuguese and other explorers going to the East Indies and to South America. Which, I mean, even if you still got sort of feudal type, you know, a landowning type class. If they're forcing their peasants to produce things to be sold on the market, not for, you know, immediate local consumption of themselves or all their peasants, you've moved out of feudalism. Even if you haven't yet got a wage working class but doing most of the production. I mean, this argument has gone on in relation to slavery in the southern states of America. You can have production for the capitalist market, which is carried out by other people than free, inverted commas, wage laborers.
Really following up on the previous commentary, when you mentioned, when does capitalism begin? How would one define capitalism begin as an all-encompassing social system?
We're going to have another dark ages between the end of feudalism and the beginning of capitalism.
I'm curious that there are capitalist sects or areas chiefed by Joel with feudalism. But as the all-powerful state, as the ruling class, would you say then that Adam Smith is the first one to lead the other, and say 50 years, 100 years prior to the appearance of the acquired human world? Would it be the beginning of the capitalist system as a ruling class?
Well, a ruling system in Britain, perhaps.
No, I'm in a bit of a quandary here. Was it you who wanted to speak? And after you, it's you, and then I've got a second time, as you say.
Something said there'd be no comparison to the 1381. Well, perhaps it's 500 years later, a different society, but very loosely, perhaps you could consider the Chartists, much more in Morris's time. A very loose comparison. Not revolution, but certainly that way in class.
No, and, you know, as historical materialists and Marxists, we see society as divided into classes. Whenever you have society divided into classes, there's going to be class conflict and class struggles. I mean, I think it's just, you know, what Paddy says is quite logical. There must have been other revolts and other conflicts we never heard about. So, okay, we're talking about, when we talk about the Chartists, we've got into capitalism. That's the early working class. Yes, yeah, I mean, it's a revolt of ordinary people against the workings of the system, and, yes.
One other comment. You mentioned a North-Southy boy. You still got it. Hmm? North of Watford. South Watford.
Well, in those days, the most industry was situated in the southeast. I mean, most of the mines, iron ore, smelting, and so on, was all done there.
Do you want to speak?
So there was majority understanding for communism during these times. Surely it would have been, would have had a, well, perhaps no success been implemented. And the forces of production would have been mostly expanded by the people as a common.
I mean, I've thought about this in not so much in relation to John Ball. It strikes me as a bit, you know, anomalous that John Ball should be advocating communist ideas when there's no evidence of anybody else. Okay. But if you take it in relation to, you know, Win Stanley in the 1640s, I mean, I think something could have worked, but it wouldn't have been what we are. I mean, they could have established agricultural communes or something, which would have been based on common ownership. I mean, they theoretically, I suppose, they could have kicked out, you know, the landed aristocracy and on that basis. But it wouldn't. Well, I mean, could it have lasted? I don't know. I mean, it's one of these if things, because the other ruling classes would have put them down and so on and so forth. And, I suppose theoretically, if you ask the question, technically yes, but it wouldn't have been socialism in our sense, as a worldwide system. It could have been some sort of little communistic colonies. That's the most that could have happened.
Now, I've got two people here, and I've got two people who have spoken before. So will those people who have spoken before just think about what you're saying and make it short, and then I'll take you quickly. Okay. It's your turn. No, they're going to think about it.
Like you said in the beginning, I'm one of those people not read John Ball, have read nowhere. I was just wondering how the two rank alongside each other.
In the front of News from Nowhere, they have this house, and I think it says something like a place of place of repose,
I think
a period of rest or something like that. Well, this one would have been a much more and I know Dick isn't here, he wouldn't appreciate the thin woman that's there, but when Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman, it's a much more sort of revolutionary thing to put on the front than the house and saying it's a place of, what was it you say again?
A period of rest.
And I mean, as I hinted at when I was talking, I think this reflects what Morris's feelings were at the time. He wrote it in 1886, the Socialist League was expanding. He was speaking every night or every other night in indoor or outdoor meetings, and he was in a much more optimistic mood. Thing would have, I mean, it's been reflected in John Ball. Whereas you get the impression sometimes, from News from Nowhere that it's describing something peaceful and perfect to reflect Morris's pessimism by that point. But I mean, they're not the same, because Morris isn't describing in the Dream of John Ball how a socialist society will make. So it's quite clear. He uses this phrase three or four times: without money, without price, we'll organize things on that basis. But I think the main message that I was thinking over about a Dream of John Ball is this idea of the change beyond the change, that and this other thing that he's reflecting on. People are struggling for something which they don't get, and when they get it, it turns out to be something else, and then the same struggle has to be taken up by somebody else later under a different name with different details. So I suppose you could say that the Dream of John Ball is a more revolutionary work than News from Nowhere. Though even so, I mean, there is a bloody revolution in News from Nowhere.
I come with hearsay and his contribution. If you could have had the success of this Dream of Ball, then you could have had a communist society. because they would have then gone on to develop the force of production. Well, no, they wouldn't have done. I think all the evidence shows that the endless paths for the world were capitalism has not yet intruded, has not yet been developed. Rural communities live pretty much as our ancestors did, at least hundreds if not thousands of years ago. They have not developed the force of production. You have got to have capitalism to do that. That is the impetus for the development of the forces of production and the kind of society that would have arisen out of a successful peasant revolt in Southeast England. Well, they would never have made that progress.
No, I think that's why I wanted to draw the distinction between the peasants' revolt and Win Stanley. I mean, I think the peasants' revolt, if it had succeeded, would have been the equivalent of a bourgeois revolution. They'd have got rid of the nobility and they'd have all been commoners, but they'd have had freedom.
Yeah, but they would have developed the force of production.
Well, I mean, I was going to say they would have had capitalism. They would have had a free market, a free labour market, a freer market in goods and so on. But no, I'm just conceding the point on, in theory, with Win Stanley. Because if you read Win Stanley, in his communist utopia, there is a big place for education, including education in science and the arts. Now, we can say it wouldn't have worked, but I mean, at least it was in his vision that that's what would have happened. That you'd have trained people to be whatever they were in the science and technology of the period. I mean, I don't think it would have worked. I think it would have been like Robert Owen's colonies in America. Eventually, it would have broken down under outside pressures of surrounding capitalism and so on. But I mean, you're right.
Now, Ron, are you going to be quick for your second time?
How quick would you like?
Pardon?
How quick would you like?
Well, you can see I've got a list here of a lot of people want to talk. So go on, hurry up.
That's taken half of my time.
Well, you should have responded right away.
The other half gone. No, come on.
Have you finished commenting, comrade? May I start now? Right. This question of the development of feudalism and capitalism, I mean, we're not going to solve this here or decide on this here and now, because historians are still arguing about it. They've argued about it for years and years. This group that's partly centred at Birmingham University, Christopher Hilton and so on, the From Feudalism to Capitalism, which was started out as a history society pamphlet, and then they've expanded into a book with a Japanese. There were all sorts of elements in it of the development. And of course, the point that O'Neill says is, when was it all embracing? Well, it isn't even all embracing yet. Capitalism has been advancing around the world piecemeal and developing the world and pulling it into the capitalist world. You see, we could look at the parallel developments going on in the trading of Venice. But that was a continuation of all the Venetian trade. So there was an element which was being put in and creating a demand for products which made it worthwhile producing commodities rather than the necessity. All of these elements went into the formation of capitalism, and some of them have been going on for an extremely long time.
Okay.
Yes, okay, I don't know. We took it right together, yeah.
Sorry.
I'd like to thank Adam for an excellent talk. I'm not one of these Morris files, or the health warning that Adam gave at the end of his talk about all of these suits and very little responses. I can relate to that because I can't bear reading. And consequently, I've been very happy that I found this whole talk as interesting as I have. That's no reflection on Adam. I didn't think it was very promising material that you had to work with. And yeah, I've learned a great deal from it. Just a few little points for what they're worth, or I can remember them. Certainly what Stair over there was saying about if there'd been mass consciousness at the time of the Peasants' Revolt, but in my opinion, that's to overlook where consciousness comes from. it comes out of the material circumstances in which people find themselves. And you're just talking about it. It couldn't have happened like that. The consciousness wouldn't have come about at that time because the material circumstances weren't right, in my opinion. I'm not as surprised to hear you say that, actually. People talked, Adam mentioned it, other people have mentioned it, about what you've called the limited demands that the Peasants' Revolt made. And this man here was talking about the limited demands that the Chartists were making. He didn't use that expression, but that's what the Chartists were doing. They were making limited demands. But actually, when you look at it, what the peasants and the Peasants' Revolt were doing, so far as we know, they were not making limited demands, because what they were actually saying was they wanted to abandon the system of society in which they live. So in that, they were being just as radical as anybody in the Socialist Party. People in the Socialist Party want to get rid of the system under which they live now, which is capitalism. Well, they were just as radical at that time because they wanted to get rid of the system under which they live, which was feudalism. That's not a limited set of demands. That's not minimal demands. That's going for the whole bloody bakery by their own lights. So I think maybe we're underestimating the power of what they were seeking if we start talking about these limited demands. And just a couple of other things sort of relate, but just coming to my brain while we've been talking about these things. One of the reasons that I've really found Adam's book very useful is because what he's done is he's shown how organic was the change from feudalism to capitalism. That's excellent. What I wondered, and it's not really the subject, but I wondered if you could say the same from the transition to slave society to feudalism, or was feudalism something actually very new that didn't really go out of the old system, it was put into place afresh, if you see what I mean. I wondered if you had any thoughts on that. The last one is a question. As Adam knows, as some other people know, this is something that I've been thinking about recently, and I am asking this for information, not as a tendentious point. I'm just interested to know what you say. You, in your talk, Adam, said that feudalism was formally abolished under Cromwell, whereas in fact it had disappeared long before. John O'Neill asked a question along the same sort of lines. If it's true that feudalism disappeared long before it was formally abolished, if it was removed and the formal abolition really didn't have any importance whatsoever, why would the transition from capitalism to socialism be any different? Why, when there wasn't a point at which feudalism was abolished, why should there be a point at which capitalism is abolished? Why can it not just grow out of capitalism and appear, and maybe after a while people will realise, oh, well, we don't have that anymore? Because that's obviously what happened when feudalism was replaced. That was an organic change. So what's the difference with the change from capitalism to socialism?
Well, I mean, in theory, there's no need to, there doesn't have to be any parallel between the change from feudalism to capitalism and the change from capitalism to socialism. But even so, I mean, you know, when I said that feudalism was formally abolished under Cromwell, it was the real last feudal rights and hunting rights, whatever it was. Yeah, I mean, the real, I mean, abolition of feudalism would have taken place sometime during that, you know, long 16th century, and it would have depended on. Well, I mean, I suppose you can. I don't know what you want to put as a date when the king finally establishes a state which can overrule, the barons and the nobles. What do you want to put it? Henry the Seventh, Henry the Eighth. But at some stage, you know, there was a strong, state. But also, back to Cromwell and so on. I mean, that wasn't an organic change. It was a civil war for control of power. And although, you know, the king comes back with all his nobles and things, and they don't restore feudalism. They don't accept as formal abolition of feudal property rights, and therefore, you know, the establishment of capitalist property rights. But I mean, if you look at France or Russia, I mean, the abolition of feudalism is done in one fell swoop you know, what was it, the night of the 4th of August, 1790 something, they abolish, feudalism in France and sometime in 1917, they abolish, all the rights of the Russian noble. It is done like that from this time on. These pieces of paper, these title deeds, these scrolls, these charters, they mean nothing. I must confess that I suppose you're right. The Socialist Party's conception is more like what happened in establishment of socialism, more what happened in France and Russia, in the sense that, at a certain point, majority wins control of political power, and that majority then declares stocks and shares, not worth anything. Government bonds, just pieces of paper, and from now on, private property, legal property rights don't exist. The means of production belong to everybody. But I mean, having said that, I mean, organic, I suppose, means growth. Socialism, it's growth and outcome. I mean, in a sense, the transition, the growth, has already started. We're a little embryo or a sperm or even where we are, and. It will grow over time, but the combination of the growth, I don't want to sound like Engels, must be the breaking of the egg when socialism is hatched or something.
Okay, Ken.
I think a lot of our trouble, everybody's trouble, with many of these notions is the definition of the terms. A word like feudalism, for example. The more I study it, the less I understand it. It's just one great muddle. It could mean anything or nothing. Capitalism, Marx's definition of capital, a vast accumulation of commodities. Well, vast accumulations of commodities have existed for thousands of years in the treasures of the pharaohs and the emperors of Babylon somebody mentioned the Sutton Hoo ship burial, a tremendous treasure hoard. That was not what made capitalism possible. What made capitalism possible was the existence of a class with no resources. And this only began in the late 1400s with the beginning of the Enclosure Acts. And a new system was introduced the moment those fence posts were driven in, enclosing land. And the peasants who were driven off that land, and if they didn't go, they were killed, became a new class, which had not existed before, of free laborers without any other resources. The way of illustrating the power of this is one of the couple of economic historians in the 30s gave instances of the difficulties of the settlers or the would-be capitalists settled in North America and in Australia, where frequently the labor disappeared into the blue yonder to become homesteaders.
You've been reading Capital.
No.
It's the second last chapter of Capital, last chapter of Capital.
Sheila Hopkins and the professor, I can't remember his name. This is the mid-30s, London School of Economics. And this gives an example of the difficulty that capitalists have if they haven't got any labor. If you've got capital, it don't mean a thing. It just on its own. You've got to have labor who have got no other resources. And this, I think, is the key to capitalism, not the existence of capital. And the word capitalism is unfortunate, and it points us in the wrong direction. The existence of it. Now, the other little items, for example, you mentioned the educated class in the Middle Ages. The only educated class in the Middle Ages were the clerks or the clerics, the church. The ruling class were illiterate. The peasants were probably less illiterate than the ruling class, in that the village school was always there, run by the priest. Little items of fact like that, I think, can help us to make sense of all this. And with the regard to the what was going on in the Dark Ages? Well, the picture was very, very different in different parts of the country. Up on the Scottish border, for example, both sides, was a sort of banded territory. The Reavers, really was, on the other hand, it couldn't have been totally without any organization, otherwise nobody would ever produce any food. So that is one example of the kind of mixed, complicated situation that existed. In 950, about, were promulgated the laws of Howldah, King Howldah. In fact, he was some sort of chieftain in Mid Wales, and it illustrated.
She said, shall I ask you to stop? So I said, kite a gig.
And here you have an illustration of the collective activity of a medieval village, a village in the Dark Ages, where you had to have 12 people to combine to make up a plough team to start breaking the soil. Well worth having a look at.
Now, comrades, could I ask for guidance? It's 11:05, and we were going to finish the meeting at 11. That doesn't really matter. I have two people wanting to talk who've already spoken. Is there anybody who hasn't spoken? And do you want me to let these other people talk?
One information from the chairman, the copy will be inserted.
Spoken before, comrade. Both of you have. Is there anybody who hasn't spoken and can speak quickly? Right.